18th, October 2017. Dear Mr. Ramey, please accept our sincere condolences on the loss of your associate, Mr. Owen Hansen. I'm sure he will be greatly missed. We are currently holding the cryptocurrency funds Mr. Hansen directed us to disperse to you. You will find a current statement attached. At your earliest convenience, please log into our secure server and supply the required access codes and applicable keys. If you wish to have the funds paid to you directly, you will need to advise us as to what kinds of currency and which banking institutions you wish us to use. If the funds are coming to you in the United States, we will require your Social Security number as well as your tax ID numbers. Naturally, we make no claims on the taxability of any of the resulting transactions and urge you to work with an accountant to be sure all taxation issues are properly handled. It is our understanding, however, that in most jurisdictions, as far as gift tax purposes are concerned, you would be considered to be in constructive receipt of the funds as of the day Mr. Hansen made the transfer, which is more than a month in the past as of this writing. Also, for a number of years, Mr. Hansen and Recursos Empresariales Internacionales carried on a very lucrative business in terms of Bitcoin data mining, for which we were able to provide accounting and banking services. If you have any interest in reestablishing this activity, please let me know if I can be of help in that regard. As with the funds disbursement mentioned above, your ability to resume that activity would require an updated set of authorization codes. Please let us know your wishes in these matters at your earliest convenience. Feel free to contact me directly at any time. We are looking forward to doing business with you. Sincerely, L. Graciela Miramar. Allie read the letter through once, and then she read it again. Owen Hansen left you money? She asked. How much? Stewart nodded and handed her a second piece of paper.
Take a look at this.
Allie examined the document. It appeared to be an ordinary monthly bank statement, complete with a complex account number. It included a beginning balance of 450 BTC minus a 0.5 BTC service charge, leaving an ending balance of 449.5 BTC. What's a BTC? Allie asked. Some kind of Panamanian currency?
BTC stands for Bitcoin, Stewart explained.
The stuff that passes for money on the dark web?
Cryptocurrency isn't just used on the dark web anymore, Stewart said. Bitcoin is one of the major forms, and Ethereum is another. They're both handy when it comes to making international monetary transfers, and also, as it turns out, for money laundering purposes. I just ran a check of Bitcoin's current value. As of a few minutes ago, one Bitcoin is worth $5,735.18.
Allie Reynolds wasn't someone who was capable of doing math in her head. She used her computer. After typing the numbers into her keyboard, she stared dumbfounded at the resulting sum. Are you kidding? Owen Hansen left you $2.5 million? She asked. Stu nodded.
And some change.
But why?
I have no idea.
What did he do? Write you into his will or something? Stu shook his head.
Not exactly. Since the letter specifically mentions gift tax rather than inheritance tax, that would seem to indicate that the transfer was made prior to Owen Hansen's death rather than after the fact.
Allie was mystified. But you never even met Owen Hansen until the morning after the day he died. In fact, you were doing everything in your power to help the cops track him down when he committed suicide. Why on earth would he give you any money at all, much less that much?
I don't believe Owen Hansen had anything to do with it, Stu answered gribly. I think it's all Frigg's doing.
Wait, Allie said. You're telling me you think Owen's artificial intelligence authorized the transfers?
I'd be willing to bet on it, Stuart said. This whole thing amounts to nothing more or less than a gigantic bribe on Frigg's part. A bribe and a gamble. She must have realized that Owen was about to disable her. Draining his accounts and transferring the funds to someone else would have crippled him financially. By sending his money to me, Frigg must have expected that when it came time to save her, I'd be in her corner. That's why she sent me the Colonel file, in hopes that I'd take pity on her and recall her files rather than shipping her off into oblivion.
But you did send her to oblivion, Allie countered. You thought she was too dangerous and you deleted that file.
There was a long pause before Stuart spoke again. You're right, he said. I did think she was dangerous. I still do. And I did delete the file. The problem is, I may have kept a backup copy.
You're saying you could bring Frigg back if you wanted to? Allie asked.
If I wanted to, Stuart replied bleakly. But that's a very big if.
Allie turned back to the letter and studied it for a time. What does recursos empresariales mean? She asked.
Business resources, Stuart answered. I already translated it.
That doesn't sound like a bank, Allie suggested.
It isn't a bank. It's more like a clearinghouse, Stuart answered. Recursos empresariales doesn't deal in regular currencies, although they network with banks and other institutions that do. Their primary specialty is handling cryptocurrencies of various kinds. Ordinary banks mostly can't touch the stuff without violating banking regulations. But this letter is the reason I may have to bring Frigg back.
Have to? Allie repeated. I don't understand.
Because you can bet that somewhere or other, Frigg has squirreled away a file containing all those authorization codes, the ones I'll need in order to access the money, which is the only way I'll be able to sort out whatever taxes are owing.
And the only way to access the authorization codes is to reactivate Frigg?
That's my read on the situation.
How would you go about doing that? Allie asked.
I'd need the Colonel file, of course, Stuart answered, and a whole hell of a lot of computer power.
How much? Allie asked.
According to the police report from Santa Barbara, when Frigg was fully operational, she had access to 800 blades, or GPUs. She might run in skeletal mode on less computer power than that, but there's no way to tell if skeletal mode would provide access to the authorization codes we need.
You're saying you need to access her completely or not at all? Allie mused. Stu nodded in agreement. Allie had a clear idea of how much computer power it took to handle High Noon Enterprises' corporate needs, including banks of off-site equipment that operated in stations scattered around the globe. Here at corporate headquarters, they were currently in the process of expanding their space in order to double their local computer power, a process that had slowed to a crawl awaiting final sign-offs by building inspectors and the arrival of currently back-ordered computer equipment.
At the time we took Owen Hansen down, I was amazed by how many GPUs he had, but now, knowing he was a Bitcoin miner, that whole thing makes a lot more sense.
What's this about mining? Allie asked.
Bitcoin isn't handled by a governmental agency, and it isn't a centralized system either. Transactions happen on the web in a public arena and are recorded for all to see in what are referred to as blockchains. People who have enough know-how and enough computer power available to do so are the ones who log all that activity. They do it on a freelance basis and are paid for each logged transaction.
And they're called miners? Allie asked. Stu nodded.
And how are they paid for doing the logging? In bitcoins, of course.
Is that where all this money came from?
Probably, Stu answered. At least some of it. And since the IRS is currently targeting Bitcoin accounts larger than $20,000, I'd be a prime target. You can bet what'll be due is more than I can pay out of pocket without accessing the funds. So Frigg has put me between a rock and a hard place. I'll need the funds to cover the taxes, and I'll need her to access the funds.
In other words, Allie mused, in order to stay out of hot water with the IRS, you're going to need to reactivate Frigg and consult with her for however long it takes to get the account passwords. Do we have enough capacity here at High Noon to do that?
We, Stuart echoed. Are you saying you'd involve High Noon in this mess?
Absolutely, Allie answered. You're part of High Noon, and your problem is our problem. But back to my original question, do we have enough computer power here?
Probably, but I don't want Hansen's AI anywhere near High Noon computers, Stuart told her. If and when I turn her back on, her operation has to be kept absolutely separate from ours. I could maybe install her temporarily in the new computers we have coming in, but
those are currently on back order, Allie added. By the time they show up, there's a good chance those taxes won't just be payable, they'll be overdue. Maybe in the meantime, we could lease some additional computer capacity.
Lease? Stu echoed, looking horrified. As in renting computers that have already been used by somebody else?
It was as if, by even mentioning the word lease, Allie had just suggested the cyber equivalent of sharing a toothbrush. When it came to computers, Stu was utterly fastidious. He had a remarkable collection of old ones, museum pieces, as he liked to call them. But only computers that came to him straight out of a box were ever allowed to hook up with High Noon's computer system. Stu's outrage might have been comical if he hadn't been dead serious.
I don't want Frigg's operating system anywhere near our computers, Stu repeated. And I don't want somebody's leased computer equipment contaminating ours either.
Heaving himself off the chair, Stu started for the door. One more question, Allie said.
What?
He asked, pausing in mid-stride. Supposing you rebooted Frigg long enough to get the passcode information from her and access the money, what would you do with her then?
Take her back offline, Stuart answered at once. The very fact that she was devious enough to lay groundwork that would force me to reactivate her shows that she's capable of strategic thinking. As for Owen Hansen's money, it sure as hell isn't mine. Once I lay hands on it, I'm sending it straight back where it belongs, most likely to Owen's mother.
Knowing Stuart was honest as the day is long, Allie didn't find that at all surprising. That settles it then, Allie told him. Our new computer space is pretty much ready to go, pending our final inspections. I say we lease whatever equipment we need to get the job done, set it up in our new lab, and put this matter behind us.
It's going to cost a fortune, Stu grumbled.
I know, Allie grinned at him. But you're worth it. Besides, once you have all that money at your disposal, feel free to reimburse us. In the meantime, see what you can do about finding the equipment.
All right, Stu conceded. But I'm telling you here and now that I don't like using anyone else's computers.
As far as Allie was concerned, that wasn't exactly news from the front. Chapter 12. With her mother's remains properly packaged and duly shipped, Graciela walked to work. It was late October. Heavy rains would come in November, but for right now it was relatively dry and fine and not too hot either. She walked with a definite spring in her step because she knew that the future was about to open up for her. Early the previous Thursday morning, when she had entered her mother's bedroom and ostensibly found her dead, Graciela had delivered a bravura performance. She had forced herself to walk the very thin line between being too upset and being upset enough. Because of her mother's long-standing issues, Graciela already had the number of a local ambulance service loaded into her phone, and she had summoned the ambulance before dialing the police.
That way, when the cops arrived, one of the ambulance attendants opened the door to let them in while Graciela, still wearing her bathrobe, sat on the living room sofa and wept. Everyone had been incredibly kind to her, from the neighbors in the building to the cops who questioned her about the incident. Had her mother been out of sorts? No, Graciela told them, not at all. Had she been upset about something? No, it had been a perfectly ordinary evening. They had watched television together. Graciela was able to reel off the names of all the programs, and then her mother had gone to bed. Had there been any indication that she intended to do herself harm? No. Had she ever done something like this before? That question posed by a homicide detective was one that required a more complicated answer, because there were several attempted suicides lurking in Christina Miramar's medical history, mixed in with her various bouts of treatment for ongoing addiction problems. Graciela was in the process of answering when Arturo Salazar showed up. She had called the office earlier to explain her absence, but the last thing she had expected was for Arturo to take it upon himself to turn up uninvited at her condo. Because officers were still coming and going, the front door was open. Without bothering to knock, Arturo rushed into the room. Ignoring the detective, he hurried over to Graciela and smothered her in an all-encompassing hug. "You poor thing," he murmured sympathetically. "You poor, poor thing. Tell me what we can do to help." What would have helped immensely was for him to get the hell out, but Graciela could hardly say that to his face. The cops, the detective, the neighbors were all there watching. They had been invited to enter. She regarded Arturo's presence in her home as an invasion, and the intimacy of his hug was a violation.
"There's really nothing you can do," Graciela said, keeping her voice civil. "I was just telling Detective Vargas here about my mother's rather complicated medical history."
Obligingly, Detective Vargas pulled out a business card and passed it to Arturo. Looking at the card, Arturo's eyes widened.
"Homicide?" he asked. "Surely you don't think Graciela here had anything to do with her mother's passing?"
"It's considered an unnatural death, so of course we're investigating," the detective replied mildly. "At this point, no one is making accusations of any kind."
Arturo drew himself up and glared at the detective.
"Graciela Miramar has been an outstanding employee at my firm for more than 10 years now. For all the time I've known her, she has single-handedly cared for her mother with utmost devotion, and without a word of complaint. To my knowledge, she has always put her mother's needs before her own."
It was grating to have to sit there and listen to him sing her praises. Here Arturo was, supposedly, championing Graciela's cause, when he merely used this as an excuse to barge into her home and nose around.
"Thank you, Arturo," she managed.
He gave her one of his smarmiest smiles along with a lingering pat on her shoulder.
"So as I said earlier, Graciela, if there's anything at all we can do to help, please let me know. And be sure to inform us scheduling for the funeral service so I can tell the girls. I'm sure most, if not all of them, will want to attend. In the meantime, you have a week of bereavement leave coming. If you need longer than that, let me know."
"I will," she said. "Of course."
"You're lucky to have such a caring boss,"
Detective Vargas said after Arturo took his leave.
"You have no idea," Graciela had told him. "No idea at all."
For years she had used her mother as an excuse to dodge any number of social engagements. Now, feigning overwhelming grief, she still held herself apart. She had left her father with the impression that the church had declined to hold Christina's funeral, based on a determination of suicide. In fact, her mother's former priest from Our Lady of Guadalupe
had come by and offered to perform a funeral mass. The people from the mortuary had also suggested that a small memorial gathering would be appropriate. Graciela had nixed both. She wasn't the least bit interested in mingling with strangers and near strangers and hearing their rote messages of sympathy for her loss, especially when what she was feeling was freedom and relief rather than sorrow. As Graciela neared the office that Friday morning, she slowed her pace. By the time she stepped inside the door, she had erased all evidence of her earlier sunny mood. Her co-workers greeted her circumspectly, treating her with the gentleness and gravity one was expected to observe around someone grieving the recent loss of a beloved parent. On Graciela's part, it was important to maintain just the right balance between sadness and appreciation as she acknowledged each expression of sympathy. It was a relief for Graciela to finally be able to tuck into her cubicle and focus her attention on her computer's screen and keyboard. The morning was half gone when Arturo walked up behind her and placed a possessive hand on her shoulder.
"Welcome back," he said. "Would you care to go to lunch?"
She wanted to shrug away from him and move her shoulder out of reach, but she didn't. She knew where this was going, and it had nothing to do with his expressing condolences over the loss of her mother. No doubt he thought that, in her weakened condition, Graciela would finally be ripe for conquest. He probably expected that after lunch and a couple of drinks, they'd finish the afternoon by spending a few hours in the little boutique hotel that, according to the other girls at the office, he frequented when it was time for one of his workday assignations. From the grapevine, Graciela had learned that the hotel was nice.
Arturo? Not so much.
Sorry, she said. I've been away for the whole week, and I've got a lot of finishing up to do on the Owen Hansen account. Arturo shook his head.
It's a shame to lose that piece of business. Senor Hansen was one of our best customers.
Yes, Graciela agreed. And that's why I'm doing my best to hang on to as much of his book of business as possible.
By all means, go ahead then, Arturo muttered, walking away. Don't let me stand in your way.
Watching him go, Graciela wasn't surprised to see him stop off at Bianca Navarro's desk on his way out. Bianca was the newest of the new hires. She was young, good-looking, and incredibly naive. Graciela suspected that she was probably dumb enough to fall for his claims. The age-old story about how his wife was cheating on him, but that he couldn't ask for a divorce on account of the kids.
Yeah, right.
When Arturo and Bianca left the office together, Graciela turned back to her computer screen. Unfortunately, despite the fact that more than a week had passed since she sent the letter, there was no response from Stuart Ramey. Nothing. Nada. That was disappointing, and there was still no word from the surveillance guy about when he'd have the bugs up and running. All she could do for now was wait. And so she went to work on her computer, answering the emails and sorting through transactions that had necessarily been handled by others in her absence. As she worked through the remainder of the morning and on into the afternoon, Graciela had an unobstructed view of Arturo's empty office and of Bianca's unoccupied cubicle. With each hour that passed, Graciela quietly let her fury come to a full boil. The man was a pig, a despicable pig, who had bullied his way into her home and laid his filthy hands on her. And now he had turned his unwelcome attentions on poor Bianca. That, Graciela decided, was completely unacceptable. Over the years, she had negotiated transactions for her father, transferring funds made in payment for hits in which people's lives had been rubbed out. But all those had been from a distance. Standing silently in the doorway, while her mother breathed her last, was the first time Graciela had been directly involved in a homicide, and to her surprise, she had liked it. She had enjoyed the challenge of the delicate dance with the investigators afterward, of playing the grieving daughter role
when she'd been anything but grief-stricken.
If anything, the whole experience had given her an exhilarating sense of empowerment.
That afternoon, Graciela shut down her work computer and clocked out of the office right at quitting time. After walking home, she went straight to the safe and pulled out the other computer, the private one. In the world of the dark web, the transaction didn't amount to much, only a bitcoin or two, but she trusted that the results would be entirely satisfactory.
Chapter 13. Once Stuart left her office, Allie returned to making Bee's emergency travel arrangements. She soon learned that the situation on the ground in the UK continued to worsen. She had managed to book seats at a flight on WOW Air from Reykjavik to San Francisco, but making the Reykjavik connection was a bust. The first-tier jet service operators she would have preferred to use were already fully booked. After another hour of searching, she finally located an off-brand jet charter service called Jet2Go, operating out of an FBO at Biggin Hill Airport in Bromley. Dan Arnold, the guy who answered the phone, sounded like an older gentleman, one who was more likely to be a pilot than a receptionist, leaving Allie to wonder if Jet2Go was anything more than a one-man operation. With the words, "fly by night," ringing in her head, she quickly checked the company's safety record, which turned out to be fine. With that information in hand, she called Bee with her latest proposal.
"I just want to be home," Bee assured her wearily.
"But wait, did you say they fly a Falcon 50 EX? One of those could make it from the UK to Sedona in two hops. Did you ask him about flying direct?"
Allie bit her lip. He was whining again. She had been so focused on getting the transatlantic piece of the puzzle ticketed that she hadn't even considered using a private jet for the entire trip.
"Look," Bee urged, "it's only money. Ask him. If he can do it, great. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. As for your worry about him being an older guy, if that turns out to be the case, it also means that he's got a lot of takeoffs and landings under his belt. He'll be every bit as concerned about safety as I am. As for that WOW flight, if you just made the reservation, you should be able to cancel it within 24 hours with no problem."
"Right," Allie thought with annoyance. "Easy for you to say. You haven't spent the last several hours on the phone trying to make that damned reservation."
"Okay," Allie said aloud.
"Anything else going on?" Bee asked.
At that very moment, she didn't feel much like telling him about Stu Ramey's being bossed around by a dead man's artificial intelligence. That story was far too complicated for a shorthand version over the phone.
"Not so as you'd notice," Allie said shortly. "I'll get back to you on the plane situation."
She redialed Dan Arnold's number.
"My husband wants to know if your aircraft can fly all the way to the U.S. She didn't bother asking how much the flight would cost because she was pretty sure she already knew. And if Bee was willing to pay the price, she sure as hell was.
"Whereabouts in the U.S., miss?"
Dan Arnold asked.
"Sedona." "Oh, you mean that little place outside of Phoenix, where the airport is up on the hill over town?"
"That's the one."
"I know where it is, but we can't land there. Sedona's runway is too short for us to take off at that altitude," Arnold said. "Had us some good customers who owned a second home there, up until the husband died, may he rest in peace. When they flew with us, we usually put down at Flagstaff. We'd fly to Bangor, Maine, clear customs and refuel there, and then fly the rest of the way in one hop."
"But could you do a flight like that tomorrow?" Allie asked.
"Yes, ma'am, we most certainly could. Where's your husband now, and what time tomorrow morning can you have him here?"
"He's in London," Allie answered. "At Claridge's."
"That's around an hour from here, depending on traffic. What I'll need from you is his Amex number, his passport number, his weight, and a global entry number if he's got one. Once I have all that, you tell me what time he wants to leave. We'll be fueled up and ready to go when he gets here. And we'll have plenty of food and drink on board so he won't starve to death between here and there.
I'll tell him to be there at 10, she said.
Okay, Arnold told her. That'll put us in Bangor around 1. It'll take the better part of an hour to clear customs and refuel, which means we should be on the ground in Flagstaff sometime between 3 and 4 in the afternoon. Will someone be on hand to pick him up?
That depends, a disgruntled Allie told him.
On what?
On how I'm feeling tomorrow, Allie answered. The way things stand right this minute, he may just need to rent a car. After providing all the necessary information, Allie got back on the phone to WOW, where she sat on hold again, waiting to cancel the San Francisco flight. She was still waiting when Camille Lee popped her head into the room. Cammy, as she preferred to be called, was a 20-something, relatively recent computer science graduate who had been hired by High Noon primarily to serve as Stu's assistant. Her parents, both of them dyed-in-the-wool academics, heartily disapproved of their daughters signing on to work for a cybersecurity company, and they especially didn't like the idea that she was working in a lab with Stuart Ramey, someone they saw as an unschooled oaf and little more than a glorified hacker. From Cammy's point of view, she had lucked into a place that was far enough away from her California-based parents to be out from under their day-to-day supervision. At High Noon, she had found work that suited both her talents and her mindset. And rather than being put off by Stu's limited social skills, she simply navigated around them. She had learned to take his idiosyncrasies in stride and often served as his intermediary to the rest of the world.
Hey, Cammy said, catching a glimpse of Allie's gloomy face. Is something wrong?
Men, Allie answered.
There's a whole lot of that going around now, Cammy replied with a grin. If you think it's bad where you're sitting, you should see what it's like out in the lab. It's been a morning-long roller coaster ride. First, Stu was worried sick about driving the Bronco, but he came back from that so psyched that he was almost walking on air. He immediately called the DMV to check on his driver's test. Because there'd been a cancellation, he managed to snag an appointment for late this morning. Then the mail shows up, and he goes racing out of the lab like his hair is on fire, only to come back grumbling about how much he hates using second-hand computers. Why would he need used computers? Don't we have a whole batch of brand new CPUs on order?
Those are currently on back order, Allie replied. The delayed delivery wasn't that big a deal, but it turns out that now we need some additional computing capacity immediately, if not sooner. That's why I asked Stu to look into leasing some short-term equipment. Cammy nodded.
Which explains it, then, she said.
Explains what?
Why Stu is in such a snit, Cammy answered. As far as he's concerned, leased and used are both dirty words. But still, what's the hurry? I thought the plan was to have the new equipment up and running in time for Lance's graduation and before he's ready to come here full-time.
This has nothing to do with Lance and everything to do with Stu and Owen Hansen's artificial intelligence. As Allie outlined the contents and likely consequences of Graciela Miramar's letter, Cammy listened wide-eyed.
Are you serious? She asked when Allie finished. Stu's really going to reactivate Frigg? I thought he said she was unreliable.
He may be right about that, Allie agreed. But it turns out Frigg is most likely the only source for the passcodes Stu will need to sort out his financial situation. That's why I suggested the leasing option. He wasn't happy about it, but he said he'd get right on it.
Don't hold your breath, Cammy said with a laugh. At this very moment, he's over at the DMV and hopefully passing his driver's test. Shirley took him, and she's letting him use her Honda for his test drive. While they're gone, would you like me to take a preliminary look-see at a leasing option? That was one of the things Allie had come to appreciate about Cammy Lee. She was a self-starter. "Would you, please?" Allie asked. "You're likely to find us a better deal than Stu will. Having him making inquiries and negotiating a deal with his nose out of joint and a chip on his shoulder probably won't lead to the best of all outcomes." "Presumably not a computer chip," Cammy asked with a smile. Allie smiled back. "Presumably." "So if the goal is to get Frigg working again, we're talking about a bunch of hardware, right?" "Yes, the works," Allie agreed. "Stu told me that before Hansen took Frigg down, she was operating on 800 blades." Cammy nodded. "I didn't know the exact number, but from seeing the crime scene photos, that's about what I would have figured. There's a shortage of CPUs right now, so trying to lease that many isn't going to be easy, and it's going to cost a bundle." "I know that, too," Allie agreed. "But as I told Stu, his problem is High Noon's problem. In terms of PR, we can't afford to have one of our principals caught up in some complicated unpaid taxes difficulty with the IRS. My understanding of Ms. Miramar's letter is this. Whether Stu can access the money or not, it's his at the moment, and whatever taxes are due will probably be payable in a hurry. Taxes Stu won't be able to cover without having access to the funds themselves." "And the only way to do that is to reboot Frigg?" "Exactly," Allie replied. "Okay," Cammy said. "I'll see what I can do." By the time Cammy left the room, Allie had been on hold for so long that she had almost forgotten the phone was still at her ear. Just then, the airline service rep came back on the line. By the time that call finally finished, Allie's email account dinged with the confirmation information from Jet2Go. Once Allie forwarded that to B, she was finally able to return to the other items on her to-do list. An hour later, she was deep in handling routine correspondence when Cammy showed up in her doorway again, this time grinning from ear to ear. "You're not going to believe this." "Believe what?" Allie asked. "After I went back to my desk, I called a couple of leasing agencies, and they practically laughed in my face. It turns out nobody has any equipment available for lease at any price. Then it occurred to me that maybe there was someone out there with a bunch of perfectly good computer equipment that was just sitting around gathering dust." "Who would that be?" Allie asked impatiently. "Owen Hansen's mother," Cammy replied. "So I gave her a call." Allie's jaw dropped.
"You did what?"
"I called Irene Hansen and asked her if she had any interest in unloading her son's computer equipment."
"And?"
"Obviously she has no idea that she's got a potential gold mine down in her basement. She told me she's hired someone who's supposed to come next week and haul away the junk, as she called it. I asked her if she'd be willing to sell it. She said if we'd come get it, we could have it for nothing. It turns out she's getting ready to sell the house and needs to clear out the basement so her contractor can start working early the following week. The junk guy is due on Wednesday. She says if we can pick it up sooner than that, the stuff is ours free for the taking."
"A collection of computers like that is worth a fortune," Allie objected. "And she's willing to give it to us for nothing?" "With her only son dead, it sounds to me as though she mostly just wants it gone. And even if we're not paying her for the equipment, there are bound to be some shipping and handling charges involved. We can't just wave a magic wand to get all those GPUs from there to here."
"What will Stu think of all this?" Allie asked.
"I'm not sure," Cammy said. "But reloading the AI into a system where it's already been resident should be a hell of a lot easier than starting over from scratch. I doubt even Stu would argue with that. So what should I do? Call Mrs. Hansen back and tell her we have a deal?"
"High Noon played a major part in bringing down her son," Allie replied. "Is she aware that we're the ones who would be taking the equipment?"
"I maybe didn't mention that," Cammy conceded. At least not straight out.
What if she finds out later and calls the whole deal off? We're better off being up front with her to begin with.
All right, then, Cammie said. I'll tell her.
All the while they'd been talking, Cammie seemed to be only half-listening, absorbed in her iPad screen. Finally, locating what she wanted, she passed the device to Allie.
This is what we're talking about, she said. It's the crime scene photo I was telling you about.
Allie looked at the array of loaded shelving units.
They're huge, she exclaimed.
Cammie nodded.
Yes, they are, she agreed. Empty, each one of these racks probably weighs about 100 pounds. Fully loaded, it'll be closer to 400.
Should we call a moving company then? Allie asked. It's already Friday afternoon. They might be able to get a crew up and running by Monday, but I doubt it.
A moving company? Cammie echoed.
You've got to be kidding. If you send a bunch of untrained movers over to pick this stuff up, you'll end up with exactly what Irene Hansen already thinks it is. A pile of junk. If you want any of it to fire up and work again, it has to be dismantled properly with both ends of every cable and every connection properly numbered and labeled.
Sounds like we'd need a team of geniuses to get the job done the right way.
Yes, Cammie replied. But it turns out you just happen to have a team of geniuses on staff, 3 of them actually. Stu Ramey, Lance Tucker, and me.
You're saying you should go get it?
Absolutely. Stu and I can rent a truck, drive to Santa Barbara, and pick the GPUs up ourselves.
With any luck, maybe Lance can come help out. He and Stu can do the dismantling while I round up a crew of Home Depot day laborers to do the heavy lifting.
You make it sound doable, Allie said.
It is doable, Cammie countered. We just have to make it happen.
Stu appeared in the doorway behind Cammie.
Make what happen? He asked.
Cammie spun around to face him.
Well, she demanded, how did you do?
One and done, he announced with a triumphant grin. I passed with flying colors.
Congratulations, Cammie said. Now go pack.
Pack? Stu repeated with a frown. What for?
Road trip, Cammie joked. Me and you, babe. We've got ourselves a whole passel of used computers that we're going to pick up, bring back here, and install in our new computer bay.
But, Stu began.
No buts, Cammie told him, dismissing his objection.
What would you say if I told you Owen Hansen's entire collection of blades can be ours for the taking?
Stu's jaw dropped.
You mean, like, for free?
Exactly, Cammie told him. All we have to do is go get 'em.
Allie held her breath, expecting a pyroclastic blast. Much to her surprise, none was forthcoming.
Free is good, Stu said. How soon do we leave?
Chapter 14. For the remainder of the afternoon, High Noon Enterprises shifted into high gear. While Cammie and Stu went off to get organized for their unanticipated departure, Allie reached for her phone and dialed Lance Tucker's number.
Hey, Allie, he said cheerfully. How's it going?
Hearing Lance's voice on the phone reminded Allie of the night years earlier when she'd first laid eyes on him. At the time, he'd been gravely injured and lying in a hospital bed in a medically induced coma. A year earlier than that, while still a juvenile, Lance had objected to the San Leandro School District's proposal to tag all their students with GPS tracking devices. Lance, a talented computer science whiz, had staged a protest by successfully hacking into the district's computer system and disabling their server. High Noon Enterprises had been called in to counter the attack. When the hack was traced back to Lance, the school district had gone after him tooth and nail. Rather than graduating with his class,
the former honor student, had sat out his senior year in a juvenile detention facility while his mother, a single mom, scraping by as an LPN while supporting her four sons, struggled to pay $100,000 in court-ordered restitution. B. Simpson had felt responsible for the dire circumstances in which Lance Tucker found himself. The kid was nothing short of brilliant. Working in conjunction with Everett Jackson, his beloved math teacher, Lance had created a game-changing program called Ghost, which allowed untraceable access to the dark web. There were plenty of people on both sides of the law who had been eager to lay hands on that invaluable piece of intellectual property, and B. Simpson had simply outbid them all. To begin with, he had paid a fair price to both Lance and to Everett Jackson's widow for High Noon to lease Ghost on a temporary basis. In addition, B. had offered to fund Lance's further education on the condition that once out of school, both Lance and Ghost would come on board with High Noon on a permanent basis. That expected outcome was due to come to fruition in the spring when Lance was scheduled to graduate from UCLA. With all that history flashing through Allie's head, it took a moment for her to realize that she had never answered the question. "Turns out things are hopping around here," she said. "What kind of plans do you have for the weekend?"
"Plans? Hitting the books, I suppose," Lance said. "Why, what's up?"
In as few words as possible, Allie brought Lance up to speed on what was going on, starting with the letter to Stu from Graciela Miramar.
"You're saying that Frigg somehow boxed Stu into a corner where he has to reboot her?"
At the time Stuart had deleted the kernel file, Lance had been the only person involved with High Noon who had mourned the loss of Owen Hansen's rogue AI.
"That's the whole idea," Allie answered.
"It's what it's going to take to straighten out Stu's financial entanglements in a timely fashion. If we delay too long, whatever taxes are due may end up in arrears. The last thing we need is for the IRS to come after him for unpaid taxes."
"Right," Lance said. "After all, since High Noon already has one jailbird on the company roster, you probably can't afford to add another one."
"You don't count as a jailbird anymore," Allie reminded him. "Your record was expunged, remember?"
"Right," Lance returned with a self-deprecating chuckle. "I keep forgetting that. But you still haven't said why you wanted to know what I'm doing this weekend. Is someone from there coming over?"
"Two people, actually," Allie said. "Stu and Cammy." She went on to explain how Owen Hansen's mother had offered to give them his collection of computers for free, on the condition that someone come to Santa Barbara and fetch them prior to that midweek deadline.
"Wait," Lance said. "High Noon is going to end up with Owen Hansen's very own GPUs?"
"Yes, but only if we can pull together a program that will get us there before the junk dealer arrives. Cammy's in the process of calling down to Phoenix to rent a truck," Allie finished. "She and Stu are planning on driving over to Santa Barbara to pick up the equipment. I was hoping maybe you could show up and help out."
"How's this for an idea?" Lance suggested. "Instead of Cammy and Stu spending 20 or so hours driving back and forth to California, why don't you just fly them over? I'll rent a truck on this side and pick them up at the airport. That way they can be in Santa Barbara dismantling that equipment before they'd even finish driving to Palm Springs. How many blades, do you know?"
800, Allie answered. Lance whistled.
"Well, that's a lot of dismantling," he said. "And a lot of loading and hefting, too. I've got a few friends here at school who are your basic starving student computer science majors. Some of them might be willing to spend their weekend earning extra pocket money. In fact, a couple of the guys I have in mind are kettlebell enthusiasts who'll be great when it comes to doing the hard physical labor. What do you think?"
Allie had grown up listening to her father recite from his collection of tried, true, and exasperatingly trite sayings. One of his favorites had always been, "A wise man changes his mind. A fool never does." This was an occasion when changing her mind seemed like the right idea.
"You've got yourself a deal," she told him.
As soon as I book their flight, I'll call you with Cammy and Stu's ETA. As for your worker bees, feel free to pay them the going rate.
Will do, Lance told her. And let Stu and Cammy know that they won't need to drag any tools along on the plane. I'll show up with everything they need, including rolls of pallet wrap.
What's pallet wrap? Allie asked.
It's heavy-duty plastic film. We'll wrap it around the racks before we move them.
Fair enough, Allie said. Sounds like you know what you're doing. Within a matter of minutes, Allie and Cammy and Stu booked on an early evening flight out of Sky Harbor in Phoenix that would have them landing at Burbank shortly after 9 p.m. When she went back to the lab to pass along the change of plans, Stu, who had yet to master all of his fear of flying issues, was less than overjoyed.
Fly, really? He grumbled. Do we have to?
Yes, you have to, Allie told him. If necessary, take some anti-anxiety meds before you board the plane. Believe me, flying for a couple of hours is a better idea than having you and Cammy wear yourself out driving there and back. Cammy entered the room toward the end of that conversation.
Wait, she said. We're flying?
Yes, Allie answered. I just booked your tickets.
So I don't need to rent a truck after all.
Lance will rent the truck in California, Allie told them. This way I won't have to worry about the two of you driving in both directions.
And speaking of that rental truck, Stu,
Cammy and Lance will be the only authorized drivers. You may have your license now, but I have no intention of turning an inexperienced driver armed with a loaded U-Haul truck loose on the state of California. On the trip home, Cammy drives and you function as co-pilot. Got it?
Got it, Stu agreed. Co-pilot only.
Allie glanced at her watch and saw that it was already a little past 2. Your plane leaves at 7, so you'd better get cracking. Stu and Cammy left the business park a short time later with Stu lugging his carry-on bag. Once they cleared out, the office seemed unnaturally quiet. Allie arranged for hotel rooms for Cammy and Stu at the Burbank Residence Inn, and then forwarded the itinerary information to Lance. By the time she finished clearing her desk, a glance at the clock told her it was already nearly midnight in London. Having missed her window of opportunity to bring B up to speed, Allie went out to the front lobby where Shirley was holding down the fort.
I'm bushed, Allie said. I think I'll head out early.
Shirley looked up from her keyboard.
A little TGIF? She asked.
Maybe a little, Allie admitted.
Since you're the boss, I don't see why not, Shirley responded with a smile. When it's time for me to leave, I'll close the shutters, turn on the alarm, and leave the place locked up tight.
Thanks, Allie said. Allie walked out into the parking lot and was surprised to see her father's Bronco sitting there. She had forgotten about it completely, and now she'd need to drive on into Sedona to drop the Bronco off at the garage before going home. With that out-of-the-way jog in mind, it was just as well she was leaving early. On weekends, and especially on Friday afternoons, traffic in Sedona was a mess. Locals had adjusted to the series of recently installed roundabouts that had been strung like so many beads along the main thoroughfares running through town. Unfortunately, the redesigned traffic patterns still baffled out-of-town visitors who flocked to Sedona on weekends. It was 3:40 when Allie drove out of the parking lot. She noticed that there was a single battered white work van still lingering in the lot. The contractors and their workers usually called a halt early on Fridays, too, but evidently whoever was driving that van wasn't one of them. Chapter 15. Ronald Webster, the driver of that late departing van, was a patient man and a dangerous one. After accepting the assignment earlier in the week, he'd spent most of the next 3 days on site at the Mingus Mountain Business Park, blending in with construction workers, masquerading as one of them, and eating lunch along with the other guys when they trooped outside to a shade-covered picnic table. Armed with a set of well-used rakes and hoes, He had purchased at a garage sale and dragging around a large plastic garbage container, Ron busied himself with pulling out dead landscaping and heaving the remains into a dumpster that was already close to overflowing with accumulated construction debris. That was the thing about doing physical labor. As long as you carried tools and seemed to be working with them, you became totally invisible and could do your reconnaissance at leisure. Had the real landscaping company shown up about then, things might have gotten dicey. But for now, it looked as though Ron was home free. As the clock ticked down on that Friday afternoon, he knew the time had come to make his move. It was now or never. Long experience had taught him that the best time for these kinds of incursions was late in the day, on Fridays. It was when people's attention spans suffered the most, leaving them distracted because they were already preoccupied with dreading their evening commute or making plans for the upcoming weekend. Webster had joined the Air Force in hopes of training for special ops, but that hadn't worked out very well. After punching out his commanding officer, he had been tossed out on his ear with an other-than-honorable discharge. His tendency for brawling carried over into civilian life, where a fatal bar fight several months later had landed him in the slammer for involuntary manslaughter. Once out of jail and back on the streets, finding legitimate work had proven almost as problematic as finding a decent place to live. Fortunately for him, his widowed mother had remarried. She had moved to her new husband's 10-acre parcel on the outskirts of Marana, just northwest of Tucson. His mom had held on to Ron's father's old Lazy Days RV, and she and Art, her second husband, let Ron live in that rent-free. Powered by an extension cord from the garage, it was hardly luxurious, but it beat living on the streets. The place had been an oven through the dead of summer, but now that autumn was underway, it was far more comfortable than the makeshift cot in the back of his work van, where Ron had been roughing it the last two nights. Before getting thrown out of the Air Force, he had learned enough about electronic surveillance to make him dangerous. Now he kept body and soul together mostly by working for marginally ethical divorce lawyers, where his main focus was helping to get the goods on the marital wrongdoings of some erring spouse. When it came to non-court-ordered eavesdropping, Ron was a very handy guy to have around. But work had been in short supply the last several months, and this week he was grateful when Robbie, one of his job brokers, had given him a call. Jobs for Robbie's clients tended to be more on the sketchy side, but they paid better. Not only that, when it came time for payday, Robbie didn't jack you around. You did the job, and he paid up. That's how Ron liked it. When Ron had been given the assignment, it had seemed simple enough. He was supposed to drive up to Cottonwood, north of Phoenix, and set up a network of listening devices and some video surveillance as well, in a mom-and-pop company called High Noon Enterprises, operating out of Mingus Mountain Business Park. How hard could that be? Once Ron arrived on scene, however, he had been dismayed to learn that each evening when High Noon shut down for the night, it was locked up tight behind a solid wall of rolling security shutters. Ron had seen the ads for those suckers on TV, where the pitch man claimed that even a SWAT team had been unable to get inside. Rather than give up, Ron realized that if breaking in wasn't going to work, he'd need to find a way to be invited. It appeared that the entire complex was being renovated, and Ron made it his business to find out as much about the project as possible. Using his job of raking and weeding as cover, he had befriended several of the construction workers, including the trio of electricians assigned to upgrade the complex's electrical service. According to them, they had spent weeks upgrading the wiring for space being taken over by High Noon and redesigned into a computer lab. The work, unavoidably delayed several times, was now complete with the exception of passing final inspections from the county building department. The moment Ron heard that telling detail, he knew that posing as a building inspector would be his best bet for getting inside. While on the job, Ron wore an impenetrable pair of sunglasses, as well as a broad-brimmed hat with a tail of material that covered his ears and the back of his neck. When one of the other guys at lunch had inquired about the hat, Ron told him he'd had a spot of melanoma removed and was under doctor's orders to keep the sun off.